Well, now, just on the subject of the EDELs and the EDEL class group, I would just remind you that, so we've got the EDEL class group. That's by definition the quotient of A star by Q star. And sitting inside that, we have the EDELs of norm 1, whose quotient modulo Q is compact. And recall that the representations, of course, we're just dealing with abelian groups here, but since this group GL1 is abelian, any irreducible representation of A star is one-dimensional. So in other words, it's a homomorphism. And let's say, for the most part, one wants to deal with unitary representation. So if it's unitary, then it's a homomorphism pi from A star to the set of complex group of complex numbers of norm 1. And we just can note that there's a free action of the additive group of reals. There's a free action. I guess maybe I'll think of it as the additive group of imaginary complex numbers. So you send a representation pi to the twist by f, namely pi of x times the absolute value of x to the s, as that's the product of all the local absolute values. And so this is a free action of IR on the set of irreducible unitary representations of this group. Notice that the orbits of this action are in bijection under the restriction map from the full group of EDELs to the group of EDELs of norm 1. Okay, so the orbits of representations of the larger group under this action upon restriction to A1 become identified. Representations in each orbit become identified with each other. And so they're in bijection with irreducible unitary representations. Of A, 1. So the point is that from the point of view of representation theory, we might as well restrict ourselves to A1, which is good because it's A1 mod Q star that's compact. If you're interested in the representations of A star, they're simply given by orbits, which are in these very simple orbits, which are in bijection with the representations of A1. And if sometimes you do want to work with non-unitary representations, so of course there's a similar statement. For non-unitary irreducible representations, but then you have to replace IR by taking complex powers, s being a complex number. So this you will recall that this is the setting, or really the setting where Q is taken to be an arbitrary number field. This is the setting for Tate's thesis, which is often is given to beginning graduate students who want to work in this area as a first thing to read. Tate's thesis, it's in the Castles and Frölich, which I gather has gone missing. Didn't go missing in the last week. It went missing a long time ago. I'm afraid it's no longer, it's temporarily missing from the mathematics library. But in any case, Tate's thesis is in the Boulder Conference and Castles and Frölich, and very beautiful use of representation theory of these groups to prove the analytic continuation and functional equation of abelian L functions attached to general automorphic representations of GL1. Well, now one wants to do this kind of thing for in general. One wants, I mean, before you even start to think about problems of non-compact quotient, you have to slice off this rather trivial object that can cause non-compactness. So one does that really before doing anything else. And what would be the analog of this for a general G? Well, you can define two things. Let me define AG to be the largest central subgroup of G, which is defined over Q. So it's an algebraic subgroup contained in the center of G. When it's isomorphic, but we ask that it be isomorphic. It's contained in the center, but isomorphic to a product. This is isomorphic over Q to a product of groups GL1, GL1 to the K. Well, then the set of real points of this group, AGR, so that's just a product of a group's K copies of R star, disconnected groups, but its connected component is isomorphic to the multiplicative group of positive reals, that's multiplicative group, to the kth power, or perhaps a little easier as we will use in our notation, often the additive group of R to the K. You have a second object that you can attach to a general group, and that this is a subgroup. The second object is a quotient, or gives a quotient of a general group. So what it is it's the set of rational characters on the group. So let's define X, G sub Q, Q meaning they're defined over Q, for the, and we want to write it as an additive group of algebraic homomorphisms chi from G to GL1 that are defined over Q. Algebraic homomorphisms mean that they are defined, of course, a theoretical notion that you never really have to deal with when you're calculating these things, but they're defined by equations with rational coefficients. Or to put it another way, if you take the points here in some algebraic, say, algebraic closure of Q, and the points here in some algebraic closure of Q, the Galois action on here and on here, commutes with this. So the additive group, so we're writing these in additive notation, even though the group is in multiplicative notation. So in other words, chi, what a sum of two such characters, is the character which assigns to a point x the product, chi 1 of x, chi 2 of x. Okay, So it's not hard to convince one yourself that that this is the question. Any question? Question? Feel free to ask if you. So then this is a free abelian group. Of rank k, k being the same as the power of GL1 up there. And so it's not always this lattice that one wants to work with, but rather a real vector space that you can build out of the lattice. So let me define A sub G to be it'll be basically a vector space that comes from the dual of this lattice. In other words, it's the set of the space of Z homomorphisms from this additive group into the additive group of real numbers. Okay, and so then this is a real vector space. Of dimension k. And let's also define then a homomorphism, Hg, from the adelic group, Ga, into this real vector space as follows. This is a group we're writing multiplicatively, and this is a group we're writing additively, so I mean a homomorphism in that sense. So I'm going to have to take a logarithm at some point. But let me define Hg. It's enough to specify Hg at any x, what it does to an element x in the character lattice. And so that is supposed to be some that better be a real number. So I would take pi of x. That is an edel. So pi is a rational character on the group. It maps the edelic group into GL1A. In other words, an edel. I can take its absolute value, as we've done over here. That would give me a multiplicative positive real number, but I want it to be additive, and so I have to take its logarithm. And so you can just check that that is a homomorphism that extends to a homomorphism from H from GA to this vector space. And then, so that is the analog over here of what of logarithm, of absolute value of x. And then let me define GA1 to be the set of elements in GA such that Hg of x is 0, the kernel of this map. All right, well, just as was in the case of the edels, GQ is going to be contained in GA1. And moreover, if this isn't sort of completely obvious, you can experiment, say, with general linear group. Well, we'll look at general linear groups in a moment. But it follows pretty easily. Just as in the case of the edels, that in fact GA is isomorphic to a direct product of GA1 with AG R0. Once again, so there's a surjective homomorphism from we've got our GA1 is the kernel of HG, but then this embeds in GA1 by embedding it into the Archimedean values of G, where it sits as a central subgroup. Now we could also sorry? So this last one was where we had the edels, are the direct product of the edels of norm 1 with the multiplicative group of positive real numbers. And then so this is the analog of this that we had last time. And then this action, this relation between representations of GA and GA1 is, we would actually use the dual vector space of AG. So AG star. And that's going to be the same thing as, instead of taking Z homomorphisms from here into the additive group of reals, we would take the tensor product. With the additive group of reals. And this sits inside a complex vector space, so it has a complexification that we can sometimes use. Let's write it as AGC star, when that would just be X of G, Q, tensor Z with C. So this is going to be the analog of R here. And that complexification would be the analog of C here in this last assertion. Or to put it more precisely, if pi is an irreducible unitary representation of GA, then we can act on it by any element in I A G star. So that's a real vector space. I of A G star is sitting in the complexification of that vector space. And if I want to take it purely imaginary to preserve the property of unitarity. And then I can define pi lambda of x to be pi of x e to the lambda of hg of x. Hg of x being a surjective homomorphism from here into AG, whose kernel is GA1. It's additive. It takes multiplicative notation to additive notation, so I've taken an exponential here, just as we did, so that it would match this notation over here. And so then this is x in GA. This is also an irreducible unitary representation of GA. And if you think about it, the restriction of this representation to GA1 will be the same for pi lambda and for pi. And so, in fact, the orbits pi lambda then can be identified. These are in bijection with so in bijection under the restriction map. From GA to GA1 with irreducible unitary representations of GA1. And there's a similar assertion if you're dealing with non-unitary representations. Once again, except you have to replace IAG star with the full complex vector space AGC star. Now, I don't know whether if you're not used to dealing with these things, perhaps they look a little abstract or hard to, look like they might be hard to compute with. They're not. I mean, you write down any group, familiar group, and you'll see right away what this group capital AG is going to be, and you'll see right away what this is. We'll illustrate it with GLN and subgroups of GLN presently. This is what you have to do to get rid of really what is the trivial contribution to non-compactness of the quotient. And because of this statement, it says that it's enough to really study the decomposition of GA1 modulo GQ, because the representations of GA1 are related in this simple way to the representations of GA. So this is really, even if you're not used to algebraic groups, it might look slightly abstract, but it's really very simple. I mean, it's a very simple kind of construction. However, simple as it is, it's pretty important. It's these parameters lambda here. So these parameters lambda up here, which are responsible, I mean, it's in a pretty elementary way. The hard thing is not these parameters, but it is these parameters lambda that govern the continuous spectrum in cases where you have non-compact quotient. I shouldn't say it's characters lambda, not really for the group G itself, but for the same construction attached to certain subgroups of G, namely Levy components of parabolic subgroups. And then it's the lambdas that come from this construction for those groups that are the are the continuous spectral parameters in that part of the decomposition of the regular representation that decomposes continuously. So they're a basic part of the rather trivial lack of compactness of the quotient is actually pretty important for the study of the whole regular representation. Well, I mean, GLN. Suppose you looked at GLN. Well, then AG, it's just actually the full center. It's the set of diagonally embedded elements in GL1. In other words, it's isomorphic to just one copy of GL1. I mean, typically what happens, the center of a typical group is a little bit larger. There could be an infinite component that is an algebraic torus, but that's not a GL1, that doesn't split. But there also could be a finite disconnected group sitting in the center. But in the case, for example, in the case of SLN, but in the case of GLN, it's just this one-dimensional GL1. And what's x of g? Q. Well, again, that's equally straightforward. You can see what it's going to be. It's isomorphic to one copy of z with generator. Okay, so this is a group of rational characters on G, and so its generator is obviously the determinant of X. The determinant being a homomorphism from GLN, algebraic homomorphism from GLN to GL1. And so then, in the case of GLN, we can write GLN A as a direct product of GLN A1. Okay, so that's the set of general linear adelic matrices whose determinant has absolute value 1. Oh, well, I'm writing, I'm writing these in algebraic group language, so I'm just saying that a homomorphism, so the convention for algebraic groups is you just, before you put something in this spot, an algebraic group is just kind of a rule that assigns to any field or even ring a group of points. So I guess I'm using this notation to be, we can think, if you like, as G, a group of points in some very large algebraically closed field. And so I wouldn't want to put, I'll put the absolute value in only when I put the adelic points. And then, so we've got GLNA as a direct product of this subgroup with AGR0. In fact, the center, the real points of the center of GLN, but embedded in the full group of real points of the GLN sitting in the adelic group. Okay, so this, of course, is... Now, if you are, if you're familiar with a little bit about classical modular forms, which I'm sure you are, you will know that if n is not equal to 1, then you still don't get compact quotient by taking off this center. GAQ mod GA1 is not compact for much more serious reasons than just this part that comes from the center. This is not compact if n is bigger than 1. We saw that it was compact in the case of GL1, but in higher general linear groups, it is not compact. And we, I guess we know that because if you think back from yesterday for the strong approximation theorem, in fact, why don't we just, for n equals 2, say, why don't we just take SL2 rather than GL2? That's even smaller. And then if you think back to yesterday, we have SL2A is equal to S, it's simply connected, it's equal to SL2Q times any, times SL2R times any open compact subgroup. So let's just write it. SL2A mod SL2Q. So this is the element whose full determinant is 1, not just has absolute value 1. And so this is isomorphic. Suppose I divide it out by a compact subgroup product over all P of SL2ZP, then so there's my open compact subgroup K0, and by strong approximation, this is isomorphic to SL2R divided out by a discrete subgroup of SL2R. So this is the maximal compact subgroup of the finite adels, and if you think back at how you got a gamma from the strong approximation, you see that it's the set of rational, what the gamma here is, it's the set of rational matrices whose projection at each p is integral. In other has a p-adic absolute value. Its components have p-adic absolute value less than or equal to 1. In other words, it's integral. In other words, it's SL to Z. But now if I were to put divide out by another compact subgroup, SO to R there, at the real place, okay, so then I'd have, that would remain over here, SO2R. So that's even, that's still dividing out by another compact group. And then this thing is isomorphic to the set of orbits of the upper half plane, H, modulo SL2Z. And so if you're familiar just with even the beginnings of classical modular forms, you will know that the fundamental domain for that action on the upper half plane is not compact. It has a point at infinity. It goes off to infinity. So you have this kind of region as a fundamental domain in the upper half plane for the action of SL to Z. So we are going to have to expect some rather more serious reasons for this quotient in general being non-compact than just having to do with the center. Well, let me mention another questions. Any questions? Let me mention another example where you do have compact quotient. And so this is where I'll take G to B. I'll call it B star, the set of non-zero elements in a division algebra. So where D is a quaternion algebra over Q. So in other words, it's a division algebra over Q with the property that that if you tensor it over Q, so it's an algebra over Q, but if you tensor it over Q with the complex numbers, you get the algebra of 2x2 complex matrices. You can write these. If you're not familiar with how these things arise in algebraic groups, you can still write them down. You will be familiar with the Hamiltonian quaternions for the reals, and they have generators, what is it, I, J, and K, such that j equals minus ji equals k. We'll do the same thing with the rational numbers. Take the algebra over the rational numbers with generators ij and k that satisfy those relations, ij equals minus ji equals k. But then instead of asking that the square of each of them be minus 1, allow the square of each of them to be a more general rational number. And you can just, if you're not used to it, you can just play with them, and you're going to get an algebra over the rational numbers. Now, sometimes that algebra tensored with C, sometimes that algebra actually would be a 2x2 matrix algebra over the rational numbers, and sometimes it won't. Sometimes it'll be a division algebra. It'll always have the property that when you tensor it with C, it's the 2x2 complex matrices. And so you can just write these things down. It's not a very satisfactory way to classify them, because if you make up different rules for what I squared and J squared are, pick arbitrary rational numbers, you might get two different algebras that are isomorphic. So it's the same kind of thing. You wouldn't want to as a general rule, you wouldn't want to write down Galois extensions by just writing down equations of which they are the splitting field. that's kind of a little bit like that. But still, you can write them down explicitly. And I guess I could mention that these quaternion algebras over Q are the beginnings of, are kind of the first evidence of a beautiful classification of reductive algebraic groups over the rationals or over any number field. I mean, it's really one of the high points of the theory that you can actually write down all algebraic groups over any number field, and it's both explicit and rich. In other words, there's lots of, you could spend months just playing with them, writing them down. It's very rich, and with a little experience, you can write them all down and calculate anything you want with an algebraic group over Q. It's a very beautiful theory. It's a combination of sort of two great theories of the early part of the last century: complex semi-simple Lie groups, or really, for the most part, classification of complex semi-simple Lie algebras, which are given by diagrams, and class field theory. And those things together give a very rich classification, a beautiful and complete classification. I mean, you need a few other things too, but they lead to a classification of general reductive algebraic groups. Well, what is that in the case of these quaternion algebras? There are many different non-isomorphic quaternion algebras over Q. However, over each of the completions of Q, they are like the Hamiltonian quaternions. There's only one division algebra over the reals of dimension 4, the quaternions. And this general classification that comes from class field theory, in its very sort of elementary part of it, tells you also over any p-adic field, there's exactly one quaternion algebra over a p-adic field. And then the global classification over Q says that for any even set of valuations, including the real one or not, but as long as it's even, there is exactly one division algebra over Q, which at each of those even number of valuations is the given division algebra, and at all of the others, almost every valuation, it's a two-dimensional division algebra. So very nice classification of these quaternion algebras. Well, it's a fact that you get to pick an even number of valuations. It can be even include the reals in that or not, and then for that set of even set of valuations, there is precisely one division algebra, quaternion algebra over Q, and it has the property that its tensor product with any of the completions in that even set is the unique quaternion algebra over that local field, and its tensor product with any completion in the remaining set is the full M2 of QP. Well, it's a sort of a basic elementary fact that you can get just by sort of writing down a norm, just writing down, playing with these division algebras in the more elementary sense, you can write down a norm, and you find that, again, that X of G in this case is again, isomorphic to Z, as would have been the case for GL2. But in this case, GQ mod GA1, this is now compact. So this is the first example of an algebraic group, a non-abelian algebraic group, where the you can apply the Selberg trace formula as we wrote down on the first day. So therefore, Selberg trace formula in exactly the form that we wrote down on the first day. It holds for F being I won't always distinguish between a function on GA and its restriction to GA1. So F, let's say in brackets, the restriction to GA1 of a function in GA. Well, there's not really time to, I mean, one could go into this in more detail, which I won't really do this, but let me try to say it in words. Not only is this the first interesting sort of non-abelian algebraic group where you've got compact quotient, but it is also the first case, I think, where there was a really spectacular application of the trace formula. It's due to Jacquet and Langlands. I think perhaps the Shimizu might have had special cases before, or was the Japanese school had special cases of it before, but the general case was done by Jacquet Langlands in their book, Automorphic Forms on GL2. And I'm afraid it's a Springer lecture notes in around 1968. I don't remember the number. Also on the web. And it's the last chapter of the book. Most of the book has nothing to do with these things, or the trace formula, but the last section, chapter 16, has a very, ultimately, really quite simple application of the trace formula. And what did they do? They showed that there is a correspondence between automorphic representations of a division algebra, quaternion algebra, something like this, and automorphic representations of an apparently quite different object, automorphic representations of GL2. I mean, they're not really related. A division algebra, if you kind of do this sort of analysis in the case of a quaternion algebra, you will end up with a quotient of the upper half plane by a discrete group that has compact quotient. Not so easy to write, not as easy to write down the discrete group as it is for SL2Z, but it's an arithmetic group whose quotient, which acts on the upper half plane and gives compact quotient. Well, there's a Laplacian. There's a hyperbolic Laplacian coming from the upper half plane that acts both on this and any other quotient of the upper half plane. And to say that you have a correspondence between, well, I'll try to describe roughly what the correspondence says, but it includes the assertion that the spectrum of the Laplacian on the compact quotient of the upper half plane injects into the spectrum. I'm cheating a little bit. I really need to allow this group to vary. I really need to consider a tower of groups. But it roughly says that the spectra for compact Riemann surfaces gotten in this way are included in the spectra for Riemann surfaces obtained by modding out by subgroups of SL2Z. And there's no way to compare these things geometrically. So it's really quite a remarkable theorem. And how does one prove it? I'm being a little vague. There's a Laplace operator on the upper half plane, a hyperbolic Laplacian, and any quotient of the upper half plane, you can form the L2 functions, and you can try to decompose them relative to the Laplacian. If it's a non-compact quotient, there's actually going to be a continuous spectrum as well as a discrete spectrum. But what is a consequence of what I'm the theorem of Jacquet-Langlands that I'm going to just try to describe in very general terms without writing it down. A consequence of that is that the spectrum of the upper half plane in which you take a discrete group with compact quotient coming from quaternion algebra, that injects into the discrete spectrum, that the eigenvalues are included in the eigenvalues that you get from a quotient of the upper half plane by a congruent subgroup of SL2Z. They're two completely different sort of objects geometrically. So, I mean, what does one do to try to compare automorphic representations of this group with automorphic representations of GL2? Well, we would integrate them against a function. So we would take a function, sort of an arbitrary test function on here, with the restriction to this of a test function on GA. And so a division algebra, remember, it has the property that for almost all primes, it's actually a matrix algebra. So for almost all completions, you're talking about a local group that's the same as GL2. So at almost all places, you could simply take the component of the test function that you're going to use for the division algebra, and you could take the same component of a function that you're going to use for GL2. Now, you still have the finite set of places at which the two completions are different. And for that, you take a test function on the division algebra, now this local component, and you look at its orbital integrals. Those are the things that occur in the trace formula. And you simply choose any test function on GL2 whose orbital integrals are the same as the orbital integrals of the function on the division algebra. You can do that because there is an injection from the conjugacy classes in a division algebra, as quaternion algebra, to the conjugacy classes in GL2. They're both they're parameterized by quadratic extensions of the underlying field. There are actually some other conjugacy classes for GL2, the ones coming from diagonal matrices, and you would ask that the test function on GL2, that comes from a test function on a local division algebra, you'd ask that its orbital integrals vanish on those extraneous conjugacy classes. But then if you set things up like that, we remember what the trace formula looks like. I mean, it's just the sum of orbital integrals. And if you take a test function on one group and you use that to define a test function on another group so that the orbital integrals match, well, then if the trace formula, we don't know what it is for GL2, but if it looks like a sum of orbital integrals, well, you're going to get a complete matching of the two geometric sides. And so they'll cancel each other off, and you're going to have a matching of the corresponding spectral sides. And we've arranged these test functions in a way that almost everywhere they're going to be equal. So it means that the automorphic representations of GL2, at least at almost all places, are going to match corresponding automorphic representations of the division algebra. I mean, this is, one has to, of course, do a lot of, to make this precise, one has to do more than just what I've said, but you really don't have, and in a sense, you don't really have to do anything. It just is handed to you by the trace formula. You've got the two geometric sides, and you just set things up in a way that between two different groups, you're able to cancel the two geometric sides, and there will then be a corresponding identity between spectral sides. Well, that's the first big application of the trace formula, and it turns out to be much more difficult to do similar things in higher rank, but that is one of the main things that one hopes to use the trace formula for. But I'm getting ahead of myself. All of this was conditional upon having a trace formula for GL2. And remember, GL2 mod GL2 GL2, GL2, A1, modulo. So I'm sure that must sound a little vague. I hope it doesn't sound too vague, but I just want to give a little bit of a flavor. I'm not going to have a chance in this course to really go do the application, but just to give a little bit of a flavor of what you would want to use the trace formula for. I mean, we really have now to consider the question, GL2A mod GL2Q is not compact. So what we wrote down on the first day, trace formula that we wrote down on the first day, the earlier trace formula, does not hold. What happens? I mean, in general, supposing you have a general group. For the example, for GL2. So, in general, if GA, in general, if GQ mod G into GA, GA1 modulo GQ, if that is not compact, if you remember the things that we used in the case of compact quotient, everything breaks down. The first thing we used was that R was a direct sum of irreducible representations that it decomposed discretely. Well, in the case of non-compact quotient, it does not. Discretely. We also used the fact that R of F for certain nice functions F, say smooth functions, that this was of trace class. False in general. It's not of trace class. And I guess difficulty, the integral over the diagonal of the kernel. That does not converge. So all of the things that we used, we don't get anything out of them. They all fail. And it's worthwhile, actually, having a look at an example to see why they fail. It turns out that all of these three sort of failures are all intimately related to each other. So if one of them is going to fail, yeah, I guess you probably would have to expect that the others are going to fail as well. So let's look at the most explicit thing we could look at is this thing here. Let's look at the convergence of that integral. So to see what goes wrong, let's consider the case that I guess might have been originally motivating this discussion, the case of GL2, where you had this really spectacular theorem of Jacquet-Langlands, but it was predicated on having a trace formula for GL2. So let's look at that case. So what goes wrong? Let's consider the case that G equals GL2. And let's take a smooth function of compact support. That is positive. So by taking a positive function, then if this integral converged, let's call it star. If star converges, Well, then remember what this, I'm sorry, I've written this down wrong. I'm getting a little carried away here. This is not the integral of this. It's the integral of the full kernel, k of x and x dx, which is the sum over gamma. So then this is the integral over gA 1 mod gq of the sum over gamma in gq of f of x to the minus 1 gamma x dx. Well, now, so this is the kernel on the diagonal, but if f is positive and the outside thing converges, well, then you know that this is going to have to converge. This is going to have to converge as a double sum if f is positive. So this converges as a double integral. All right, now if that converges as a double integral, then all of the manipulations that we did on the first day are going to have to also be valid and to converge. So if this converges, this converges as a double integral, and by the manipulations that we did on the first day, the integral over GA, the sum over gamma in the conjugacy classes, GQ, GA1 modulo GQ, of the volume of G gamma Q into G gamma A1. So this was the more complicated but perhaps more down-to-earth sum that we got out of this, GA1 modulo G excuse me, I don't want this integral here. The final thing was a sum over conjugacy classes of the volumes of these centralizers, and then the integral over the full group modulo the centralizer of gamma in the full group. This is what we got from the manipulations of the trace formula. So this is the sum over conjugacy classes in GQ here. That was what we got. And so if the original thing converges for a positive function, this is going to have to be finite. Well, various things can go wrong that will prevent that from happening, and we'll just look next time at the case of GL2 and see what kind of things do go wrong that makes this thing fail. Because there are things we're going to have to correct to get a formula for compact quotient.